month to go until Selection Sunday. How about that, folks? We are cruising along 27 days as of today from the day where we pick a field and stick with it. So season has flown by. We've had a lot of great games, lots of upsets in the past week. But Brad, I think what we need to really discuss, we've got some weird stuff to discuss on this podcast today. I know we're going to get into, you know, all the losing I had over at BovadaSportsbook.com this weekend. We're going to get into all the upsets about Memphis, about Houston. We're going to get into, you know, some of these Final Four potential teams, some of the conference races going on in the wire. But Brad, there was some weird shit that happened in college basketball this week. Some really weird shit.
Should we start with your Siena Saints?
The Saints had a weird weekend. So first off, they played a 70-64 win over Iona on Friday night, 9 p.m. national TV game. Students stormed the court. Great win for the Saints. Came back from 10 down in the second half. Kind of the opposite game script to last year's MAC tournament game against Iona when Siena led by 10 in the second half and blew the lead. That was fun. Siena looked good. They battled. Brad, were you watching the Saints, or were you just bitching about court storms on Twitter?
No, I was just bitching about court storms.
Anti-court storm, Brad. Why?
Well, for me and your boss, Mr. Doss, are on the same page. On the Field of 68. He was saying exactly, we are exactly in sync here. Real, you know, proud programs don't storm the court. That's underdog stuff. You know, you want to be proud.
Fair enough. Well, the only reason why I was anti Siena's court storm on Friday was I was worried that Siena was giving Iona motivation for the MAC tournament. I was like, no, don't do that. But good win.
USC stormed the court against UCLA. Yes. I mean, come on, guys. I mean, those teams are probably like five spots apart. You know, like UCLA is probably like a top 12 team, and USC is like a top 16 team storming the court. Oh my God.
But anyway, that was the least weird of the two Siena games this weekend, because Siena went to overtime against Ryder, and a lot of weird shit happened, Brad. This was Sunday, Super Bowl Sunday. I don't blame anyone if they weren't watching. But a few highlights from this monstrosity of a basketball game. And Siena wound up winning and covering. I hate betting on Siena, but I did bet on them that day over at Bovada, because I just felt like, you know what? They're coming off the high. They're coming off the win. They're dogs. We like a live dog. So, first off, we had a Chris Webber. Colby Rogers of Siena was trapped in the corner in a trailing by one with 21 seconds to go and called timeout. And they called the tech for not having a timeout, even though Siena all thought they had a timeout. It wasn't like everyone else on the team was like, no, you didn't have a timeout. You're an idiot. Everyone was like, no, we had a timeout. So they like went to the book and they're like, yeah, no, they didn't have a timeout apparently, but it was all very confusing. So Siena gets teed up. The kick goes to the line. He makes one of two. Siena fouls because they don't have the ball anymore. Ryder misses the front end. Siena goes down, makes two free throws, sends the game to overtime. Also, of course, this was just the beginning of the madness, Brad, because
what was your live reaction to the Chris Webber moment? Were you like losing your mind?
So I had kind of like resigned myself to the fact that Siena was going to lose this game with like 12 minutes to go. Like they went down five and I was like, yeah, you know, they're out of gas and they couldn't make any shots. Like they couldn't make three. They're like, all right, well, whatever. Who cares? Moving on. I was like, all right, we got the win over Iona. I'm happy. And then they started to make the first one. Like, okay. But I was like rolling up to Loyola. So I wasn't like paying as much attention. Then I see we get Chris Webber, and I'm like, what in the world? So that was rough. But then, Brad, Ryder turned the ball over because they thought they could run the baseline after a offensive foul. And so they threw the ball on the baseline from one player to another, and they're like, no, you can't do that turnover. And then Siena had a 1-1. They missed the front end of a 1-1, and Demencio Vaughn, literally no one moved. And Demencio Vaughn just like tapped the ball towards the official, and the official just got out of the way. It bounced out of bounds. So it was out of bounds Siena basketball. It was hilarious. And Siena ended up winning on free throws. So not exactly a great game. But this is what you – I tell people this all the time. You got to watch one big league basketball. There's so much, like, random, dumb, entertaining shit that happens. And I think a lot of people – for a lot of people, it's like the gambling side. Like, you know, they just roll up, fire up about it, and they're like, all right, let's have some fun. But you can have some real fun just watching some really bad mid-major basketball.
I prefer to watch the high-major teams, but, you know, to each his own.
Well, no, I like both. You know, there's a place for each. I mean, I was bouncing between just now Virginia and Virginia Tech, and then Coppin State was playing playing NC Central. I was checking on my boys from Coppin. Coppin State game goes into a delay because someone broke the rim on a dunk.
Was it Chris Monroe?
No, it was not. It was Remy Lemovu, JUCO product for Coppin State. But Chris, I don't think Chris Monroe was shaking any rims. But anyway.
Stats earlier, I've been telling you he's gonna heat up eventually.
He's been playing good ball. Playing good ball. Brad, we have one other weird thing we need to discuss from this weekend, other than Siena's madness. And this you have a lot to say about this situation. The Purdue shot clock. What's the deal, my friend?
This is outrageous. I first learned about this. Who is Purdue playing? Earlier this week, not Maryland on Sunday. Who was the game
before? It was the Illinois game on Monday.
Yeah, so I'm watching that game, and they go, and they're just, like, explaining Purdue's shot clock. Hummel was on the call.
Yeah, Hummel, yeah.
They're just explaining it matter-of-factly. Like, oh, yeah, once we hit 5 seconds, we then go to decimal points, and it goes, like, 4.9, 4.8. Like, you look up at the shot clock, and it's not showing 4.8. It's showing like 48. How is that acceptable? The clock shows the wrong thing, and it was that's just what that Purdue clock does.
It was ridiculous.
So you look up, it's I have 20 seconds. Oh no, shot clock violation. Two seconds later, and it's like yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, that needs to be corrected. Like, why is that allowed?
And so I was not watching the Maryland game, but when I turned it on at the very end, I saw one, I don't remember which team, but one team lost the ball because they took a timeout for a clock malfunction, which then the inbounder lost the ability to run the baseline because of a clock malfunction timeout after the main basket. I don't know if that was related to our friend the shot clock with the decimal points.
Whatever's going on with the clock at Purdue, it needs to be fixed.
Yeah, we got shot clock malfunctions, regular clock malfunctions. I mean, this is ridiculous.
So what's the bigger concern, Brad? Purdue's clock or Purdue's defense?
Well, good thing for Purdue's opponents is that neutral site, Big Ten tournament, the NCAA tournament, the clocks may work. So
you would hope.
Still have a chance. No, their defense is just their defense shouldn't be good. Like, looking at the personnel, you got the big 7'5" lumbering center playing half the time. I mean, Williams is a bigger guy. I know he's gotten better defensively. But you're looking at like Isaiah Thompson and Eric Hunter and Stefanovic. I mean, they're small. They're Thompson and Hunter are very slight. They're not great athletes. Defense shouldn't be that good, but seems like there has been a few key moments where Purdue's really locked in and defended. But I think overall with their personnel, I don't think it should be a surprise that their defense isn't great. You know,
I just can't trust Purdue. Right? Like, you watch them sometimes, right? You watch them, like the Illinois game that month, Tuesday night, I think it was. Either Monday or Tuesday. They were outstanding. I mean, their defense was locked in. I mean, Illinois didn't hit shots, but their defense looked locked in. They took away Coburn for the most part. You know, Ivy was on fire. You know, Edie's doing his thing. Travion, the bench is giving him minutes. They're hitting shots. Like, you watch, like, oh, yeah, that's top 13. That's a dangerous club. To then turn around from that and have your next two games be getting housed on the road at Michigan, looking completely inept, and then inching truly inching past Maryland on your home court without Eric Ayala, needing a bad call from an official to get over the hump. I mean, and Maryland didn't even shoot the ball well. Like, this wasn't Maryland going berserk from three. Maryland shot 5 of 18 from three. And Purdue almost lost that game. Fully healthy Purdue. Like, it just baffles me, right? And it's like, when we look at, you know, national title futures, and you see Purdue at Bovada right now having the fifth best odds, tied with Kentucky, we're like, I just can't get there.
I mean, listen, they have three, like, elite college basketball players with Ivy, Williams, and Edie.
Yes.
They surrounded them with a couple of really great shooters and a couple of really nice blue guys. And, you know, it's kind of replicated the synergy from, like, Carson Edwards level Purdue, where you have Nojel Eastern and Ryan Klein and, you know, Grady Eifert, and, you know, the whole mix there is kind of working greater than the sum of its parts. I think the difference between this synergy makeup and the Carson Edwards one is, you know, that one had some serious defensive talent. You know, you had Eastern in there with some great positional size who could defend like 1 through 4. You don't really have, you know, this synergy lineup was created to be this unbelievable offense, but a lot of these guys aren't pulling their weight on the defensive end.
Yeah, I also think that this team, compared to that, you know, Carson Edwards Purdue team, really both Carson Edwards Purdue teams, right? Like the Vince Edwards one or not. I think the one thing that's missing is like the late game execution. They don't make free throws. Ivy's really erratic. You don't have a steady point guard necessarily that you can go to. They don't close games very well. And this has been a, you know, consistent problem. It wasn't necessarily the case with, you know, the Maryland game. They weren't great down the stretch of the Maryland game by any means, but it wasn't like, I didn't think their late game stuff was catastrophic. I just think like, I don't know how I trust them. And when you're talking about championship level teams, right, if you're sorting through, it's like, who are the 6 or 7 teams you really believe in? Is Purdue in that conversation? I mean, again, there's all sorts of numbers that say that the defense has to be better for them to be a Final Four team or a national title team, right? That like there's mountains of like years of data that's like, you know, teams who are aren't top 75 in KenPom defense are not going to be Final Four teams. You know, that's its own issue. But beyond that, I still don't know that I trust them to be in that kind of top 7 or 8. And I feel like that's disappointing given how talented they are.
I wonder if an end-of-game issue is because they run a lot of their offense through Edie and Williams, Edie especially, right, where when it's the end of the game, right or wrong, teams just aren't going to play through the post. You know, like your last possession of the game, there's 10 seconds left. You're not dumping it in for Edie to do a jump hook, right? It's going to be a pick and roll with the ball in Ivy's hand, so like you're doing something totally different.
But that's what they wanted to do, though. Go back to the Ohio State game. I was there. Like what Painter said and what Ivy said and what Edie said was that they were running a set on that last play to get a post up for Edie. And Ivy ran the wrong direction to blow up the play. And Ivy takes like a 26-foot fader and knocks it down.
I think they
want their identity to be through the post, but it just hasn't worked.
Well, like it's very frenetic and, you know, during live action, it might take you 15 seconds to get the ball into the post. You know, right. A couple ball reversals and they're front of the post and you have to screen away and get Edie in motion or maybe a ball reversal and then you can throw it over the top. And when it's frenetic at the end of the game, you don't have a lot of time and the ball's in the guard's hands. And how many NBA games, how many college games do you watch? And the last play is 99% of the time in the hands of the guard. And sometimes the big will get it on a dump off or a put back, but it's in like the history of basketball, it feels like it's always the guard who's required to make that end of game play.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Do you think they're the best team in the Big Ten?
No, I'm still on the Illinois bandwagon. I know that they just got pounded, but there's just something about this Illinois team that just really scares me. Like, out of all the teams in the Big Ten, the one that I would say I'm scared of the most by far is Illinois. With their shooting, with their depth, with a big man in Kofi, who's great offensively. He doesn't have the offensive polish of the Purdue bigs, but he's also a monster on the defensive end as well, and he can really rebound. And I just love the makeup of that Illinois team and how well they're built and the mix between the shooting and just having a monster in the middle.
I think the one thing that I am held back by with Illinois is, like, I still don't know that they have an identity.
Like, I mean, that's we throw that around a lot, but, like, what's like Arizona's identity?
Arizona's identity is that they're going to play fast, they're going to take everything away at the rim, and they're going to let Mathurin and Kreese fire away.
I mean, is that different than having a monster in the middle, letting Frazier and Plummer fire away? You know,
I guess my point is, like, especially the Curbelo factor. Like, I feel like on any given night, I can see a different Illinois. And that's both a good thing and a bad thing. Like Curbelo has had really good games both times against Purdue. Maybe that's a statement about Purdue's defense. Maybe not. Because literally, yeah. like if you go back, since Curbelo came back from the concussion against Purdue, he had 20 points, 6 rebounds, and 3 assists in that game. And he had 15 points on 4 for 10 from the field against Purdue in the game at Mackey. He has a combined 18 points in the other 4 games. And again, he just hasn't had time because even as soon as he got back from the concussion, he got COVID. It's just been tough. But like he turned it over 4 times against Northwestern. Northwestern doesn't turn you over. Like, I guess my thing with Illinois is, like, I really like them. I like that they guard. I like they can win in multiple ways. I like the fact that they can really shoot the ball. And I obviously like that they have Kofi. And I trust Underwood at a high level. I'm just not, like, I'm not 100% there. Like, do you watch Illinois and say that's a Final Four team?
So do I think that they're one of the 4 scariest teams? No, I don't.
Well, no. But, like, could you realistically see Illinois in a Final Four?
Yes. But they're not one of the 4 scariest teams.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, like, I don't think anyone.
Petrified to play Gonzaga. I would be petrified to play Auburn. I'd be petrified to play Kentucky. Kentucky's probably the most appealing of the 4 number one seeds. Like, I think you'd rather play Kentucky than Arizona, Auburn, or the Zags. But, you know, that's another tough matchup. Yeah. And now that Baylor's hurt and Kansas is kind of all over the place, you know. I think Illinois is on par in terms of scariness with Baylor, Kansas, Duke, Alabama, and you know, teams like that. But
yeah, plus 550 over at Bovada to make a Final Four for Illinois right now, which I feel like is a reasonable number. It kind of puts them in like the 10 to 20 range nationally, which I think where we both would agree that they really should be considered.
I think I have them a little higher than, right?
You think they're a top 10 team?
Top 10, yeah, I do, yeah. Okay. But, you know, on that point about what's Illinois going to do basically with Curbelo or without Curbelo, you know, there are a bunch of teams right now that are trying to integrate somebody back in or will have to in the near future after a midseason injury. I mean, you look at the Seton Hall guys and now Aiken's still out. You look at Memphis and Imani Bates, are they going to have to integrate him back in? Providence with A.J. Reeves.
I don't – we can talk about this, but I don't think Memphis should try to bring back Imani Bates.
Well, that's kind of the whole thing with all these guys, right, is
– Well, I think
during the regular season, you can get – you know, you can roll out A.J. Reeves for 18 minutes and have him get a couple threes up, and if he's playing well, you can keep him in there, and if not – you know, you can sit him, and it's just like it was when he was out. And, you know, same with Curbelo. And, I mean, Memphis doesn't have as much of a cushion as Seton Hall, Providence, or Illinois. But, they could do that with Amani too. And if it's not working, you know, then they can just sit him in the postseason.
But. So I think the thing with Amani, and this is much less the case with Curbelo, but I think it's more relevant with Curbelo than, like you mentioned, AJ Reeves or like some of the other more minor injuries, is these guys are like potentially chemistry destroyers, right? Like Memphis's chemistry has seemingly been terrible all season long. And they're starting to figure it out as soon as Amani leaves. The last thing I'm doing is bringing him back in. Like, it's already a powder keg. Like, why? There's enough personality. There's enough talent. Like, what's the value, right? I think with Curbelo, you could make a similar argument. The only reason why I would say you got to try to bring back Curbelo is Illinois does not have another ball handler. Illinois has Frazier and Plummer, and that's it. Like the Melendez kid is on a ball handler as a wing. You know, they have like four centers on the roster. You know, they have all these wings like Damonte Williams and Jacob Grandison and Luke Goody, who are not like guys you want the ball in their hands. Like, they really are so reliant on Frazier and Plummer that you almost need to have Curbelo there just so that he can give him a breather, if nothing else. But I think it's hard to, you have to be very careful, I guess is my point with Curbelo, because I just don't know that, I don't know that necessarily it's the right answer to try to it's going to be challenging to reintegrate him fully into this rotation.
Well, I think it was Field of 68 last week, maybe, Archie Miller brought up a point that I never really consider, is that in the NCAA tournament, the TV timeouts are so long that, like, guys don't get tired. So, I mean, you could play Frazier and Plummer 35 minutes each and then have Curbelo just in there briefly if necessary. But
that is quite interesting. That's a good point by Archie. Shout out to Field of 68, outstanding programming. Catch me on
You would never remember about how long the commercials are, how they play the ads over and over, you know, the same commercials over and over.
Because you bounce around game to game.
Right. And then it'll come back to you in, like, you know, month or 5 weeks whenever we're there.
And well, I don't even do that because I flip over to another game. I'm watching the game and I watch the, like, top score bug, you know?
Yeah.
And as soon as the clock starts running, I just flip it back. It's usually pretty good.
It flickers now, too.
Oh, yeah. One, it helps it, and it helps that I've never been a fan of a team playing in the NCAA tournament since right. I was like 10. You've had the Friars a few times. But Northwestern, I didn't really care until I got into Northwestern the day before they played Gonzaga in the second round, the day after they beat Vanderbilt. So I watched that game, but I wasn't, like, obviously, like, a fan yet. I was just like, yeah, go Cats, I guess. I didn't know any of the bits. So
it was funny because Sean Miller was talking about when Arizona had to fly out to Providence to play in the 6-11 game against Wichita State versus somebody else, and, like, he didn't know who they were going to play, and he had to game plan against both teams, and then Wichita State came and blew him out. And I was at that game, and Providence was playing at the same time, but obviously I bought the tickets way before.
Was this the USC watching in the hallway game?
Absolutely. And the game was such a horrible game between Arizona and Wichita State. Wichita State was way up. So we all kind of gravitated to the hallway. They had this tiny little old TV up playing the Providence USC game. And there was like a thousand people crowded around this one TV watching a Rodney Bullock buzzer beater.
There you go. Shall we move on to let's hit Memphis quick, because I mentioned the Amani Bates.
Did you watch the Houston game?
I watched parts. I didn't watch the whole thing, but I watched.
How would Houston breathing life into the whole conference?
Oh my gosh, so selfless of them.
You knew that this was coming too. I mean,
yeah.
Walking.
I thought they'd lose one. I just didn't know they'd lose both.
Memphis has a chance to stick. They have some tougher games down the stretch. Like, I think that they go to Cincinnati, I think, and they have SMU as well. So they're going to have to take care of business, but certainly talent level wise, they're head and shoulders above the rest.
So their closing schedule is at Cincinnati, at SMU, home Temple, home Wichita, at South Florida, and home Houston. So you got to win at South Florida. You got to beat Temple at home. You probably got to beat Wichita at home. Because Wichita is right on the cusp of Q2 versus Q3 at home, just because right now they're the best, they're the easiest Q1 in the country, road win at Wichita State. Because they're not very good. But anyway, you got to at least probably, you probably need, to feel safe, you need 2 out of 3 of Cincinnati, SMU, and Houston on the road. Or not, well, Houston's at home, but the other 2 on the road. You probably need 2 of the 3 to feel safe and 1 of the 3 to feel at all, feel like you have a shot going to conference during the week.
But hey, I mean, I was looking today and making my just guess bracketology, no looking at quadrants or anything. And when I was finished, I was 4 teams short.
Yep.
So between Memphis, Michigan, Rutgers, SMU, BYU, you know, there are plenty of teams that are going to be.
So I have Memphis there. Last team in right now.
Yeah.
Perfectly. I think they deserve that, right? Like they have 4 quadrant 1 wins. One of them is the cheap Wichita road win that really should be Q2 and probably will wind up Q2. But they have 5 combined Q1 plus Q2. They have the Alabama one, which is nice at home. They have the road win at Houston, which is awesome because remember the net, you know, the net's primary value is as a sorting tool. Houston is number 5 in the net. That doesn't necessarily mean that Houston's the 5th best team in the country, but according to the net, it's a top 5 road win for Memphis. So that's a resume topper without question. And I think the other thing with Memphis is resume, from a resume standpoint, is the losses that they took don't look nearly as bad.
Yeah, Tulane is top 75 in T rank. I was still out of my chair today.
So we'll just go. I'll just go through them all in the net, basically live, right? So Iowa State on a neutral, we were like, wow, Iowa State stinks. How are they getting blown out by them? Is 43. They're likely to stay top 50, I think. Maybe they fall out and it's Q2. Worst case, right? But they're like solidly in the top 50. They lost at Georgia. That's a bad one. That's Q3. They lost at Ole Miss. Now, Ole Miss is pretty much where we expect them to be, I think. They're 108. That's a Q2 loss. Not that
bad. I thought that they would be an NIT team, but...
Yeah. So you thought maybe that could have been a Q1, but whatever. And then Murray at home, I think that's the real difference maker, right? It was Murray at home. We thought, okay, maybe that sneaks Q2. Maybe they wind up top 75, but probably that's a Q3. Instead, it's a Q1 game. So that's really not a bad loss, obviously. Then you have the Tulane road game. Tulane right now in the net is 105. So solidly Q2. Again, you would have probably thought Q3 coming into the season. Really, when they lost that game, you'd have been thinking Q3. They lost at East Carolina. There's your other Q3. And then they lost at home to SMU. Solidly Q2. So, again, their resume isn't that bad. The neutral win over Virginia Tech is beautiful because Virginia Tech is like a net cheat code. They're the East Coast Washington State. I think Memphis is in decent shape. I think they started to figure out how they need to defend to be good. I think they've started to figure out that DeAndre Williams needs to be a more featured part of the offense. And I think they've realized that they're better without Amani Bates, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And Memphis has a talent. The defense is better, and you know we'll have to see if Houston's going to continue to drop. I mean, they're not going to drop out of the top 75, obviously, but they could drop maybe to like the 20 or something, and it's not like a incredible win anymore. It's just a very good win. So
I will say the thing for me with Houston, they've been so dominant in AAC play for the month without Sasser that I almost think they're not upsettable because they're too like they're just too
well coached
too by quadrant one teams though. What I'm saying is Houston's not going to fall to 20th because they're already blowing all these teams out and they're going to blow out like UCF at home. They're going to blow out like you know, Cincinnati at home, just like blew out Cincinnati on the road, right? Like they're gonna blow out enough of these teams, or their metrics can be really good. They're not gonna lose. Like I don't think I'd be surprised if they didn't lose down the stretch.
That'd be an interesting one to watch.
Yeah,
you mentioned Georgia earlier. I think
it's possible they could drop, but I don't think they're gonna drop by 20.
You mentioned Georgia earlier with Memphis's resume. Did you see that? I guess someone on the Georgia staff, I don't know if it's Tom Crean or one of the assistants, has just been heavily recruiting all these five stars lately. Andrew Slater put like Georgia, parentheses 5-19, or 6-19, whatever the record is, was in to see five stars, Naz Cunningham, McKenzie Mbako, like all these five stars. Like what? Like, do you think Tom Crean's just like, hey, you guys got 3 weeks to commit to Georgia or else I'm going to get fired?
Hashtag commit to the G. Well, no, I mean, honestly, though, it's not the worst strategy of like try to go like throw a bag around, especially if you have an NIL guy you couldn't deal with, right? Like throw a bag at a kid who's good and get them to commit, even if they don't stay committed, just to like give your AD something to think about. It's not the worst idea.
Or it's like assistants going out trying to get in good with them, be like, right, oh, yeah, my next job's going to be at so and so, and then you can follow me there or something.
Yes.
Very funny.
Well, I also, yeah, and then we'll move on. I also was sent Chase Clemens, he's top 150 kid in 2023. His cut list that he announced today was hilarious for a 2023 kid. Georgia, Tennessee, Houston, Tennessee State, Nebraska, and Missouri. All right, so Crean, current coach recruiting him, he's not going to be there by 2023. Rick Barnes, you'd think he's still at Tennessee, but you know maybe he retires. Houston, Kelvin Sampson, yeah, he'll probably be there. Tennessee State, can't rule out that Penny Collins will get fired there, but I can't pretend that I'm an insider. Nebraska, Hoiberg's going to get fired in the next 2 years. And Kwanzaa, very good chance he gets fired. Like, what are we doing here? Like, what is the point of this cut list?
Well, how about Cassius McNeely committed to Maryland to Danny Manning?
Well, Maryland's been making all these cut lists. I don't understand what they're doing.
It's funny. I had asked Kevin earlier because I feel like the last, like, five things I've seen on Maryland was, like, one of the candidates for Maryland is Andy Enfield. And that's and that would be the only candidate listed in the piece. So I was like, you know, are we reaching a tipping point where this is Andy Enfield's job to lose? But you didn't think so.
No, I think it's mostly just that Andy has not done a very good job of keeping quiet that he's interested in the job. And no one else has really like made it known that they really want it. So it just kind of now it's like, oh, Andy Enfield and the candidates. But anyway, enough on Memphis, who is, again, positioned to. They're in position to be in position, as a great college basketball analyst might say.
Hey, if they're in your bracket now, then they're fully in position.
They're not even in position to be in position. They're just fully in position. How about that?
Yeah.
Curious thing is, so Northwestern was two wins away from being in position to be in position, Brad. So if you're two
I wouldn't
wins
hold
away,
your breath.
I know, but I'm curious about this. So if you're two wins away from being two wins away, or if you're two wins away from being in position to be in position, and you lose a game, do you stay two wins away or do you become three wins away?
Three wins away.
So when Northwestern lost to Illinois, they became three wins away from being in position to be in position. We're running out of games here.
Speaking of one team that was quickly falling out of position, BYU.
Yes.
This snuck up on me. They only have three games left. So their overtime win over Loyola Marymount literally like saved their season.
I think that's low-key a good thing, though, that they have, like, no games left.
Exactly, because they can't do any more stupid stuff.
Shit,
they have
yeah.
St. Mary's, which they can lose, and they're probably still fine. And then they have Pepperdine and Loyola Marymount, both at home, I believe.
Yeah.
You just win those two.
They don't come close to passing an eye test right now, though. It's really bad.
Hey, I told you that in August.
Well, yeah, but they had some real wins. Now they just, like, they have... Well, what's your favorite saying, Brad?
Their carriage is turned back into a pumpkin?
Yeah, that's the one. And that's what's happening to the Cougars right now. They have no shot creation other than Barcelo.
I mean, I was looking at their resume earlier, but I mean, it's a blowout win over Oregon, who was struggling at the time and is now presumably back to struggling. And they had a bunch of these like NIT type of teams. But they had Utah State and San Diego State.
But
and,
if you win enough of those, I mean, it matters.
So, yeah, so they have those three games, and the WCC does a good job of protecting their top seeds. So if they are, oh, actually, they could be in fifth place. That Santa Clara could be in front of them. So I don't know how that's going to.
Well, Santa Clara, I think, is a lot left. Santa Clara still has Gonzaga another time. So that's another loss. Because, well, I also this is, I don't know if this is like out there, but the WCC is going to use, because not everyone's going to play 16 conference games. Some of them are going to be at 15. The WCC is going to use the, and some of them are going to be 18, apparently. They're going to use like what they did last year with the adjusted like KenPom standings, where like they adjust for like strength of schedule or whatever. So that could screw things up for who gets the last bye, which again is very important because, you know, you don't want to have to play, you know, Pepperdine or Loyola Marymount, even though those teams aren't very good. Right, like San Francisco has been demolishing them. San Francisco were the fifth. It doesn't really matter. But,
well, I mean, San Francisco lost to Portland.
Yeah, but Portland, I was about to say, talk about Portland. Portland is sneaky.
I mean, they got to hire a sitting head coach who just made the NCAA tournament. And all these high major schools are fighting over assistant coaches.
I know it. But how about this? Portland is over 500 at the latest point in the season since the 2014-15 season, when they went 17-16 overall under Eric Revenue. How about that? Year one, they didn't bring back a single scholarship player from last year. Every single player left. Brought in some new guys, here they are. And they don't have a single senior in their rotation. They have one guy who's a fourth-year kid in Moses Wood. Remember Moses Wood?
From Tulane and UNLV?
UNLV, but he's only played three seasons, so he's you feel like he's definitely back. They get another year to recruit. They're 4-6 in the league, but they have a nice close. They close home San Diego, home Pepperdine, at Pacific, and at Santa Clara. They could very feasibly go like it is conceivable that they could go 7-7 in the WCC. If they go 7-7, Shante Legan should win WCC Coach of the Year without question.
No, it should be Mark Few.
No.
I'm done for giving what? Coach of the Year to the middle of the conference. I'm done.
For what? Well, what
Mike
did Mark
Anderson
Few?
Was well, Big East Coach of the Year last year. Now we're all running them out of town.
Wow.
Mike Hopkins, I think, has won two Pac-12 Coaches of the Year. Stop giving Coach of the Year to the middle. You win the league, you get Coach of the Year.
Then what is the point of the Coach of the Year?
You did the best coaching job. You won the league.
But what did Mark Few really do the best coaching job? He had if Shante Leggins had Chet Holmgren, Drew Timmy, and Andrew Nembhard, do you think he would have won the league?
Well, Shante's got to recruit a little harder then.
Well, no, Shante has to work at a place. It would be nice if Shante worked at a place with a $10 million budget.
We're not going to scale or
hey. Brad, why are we slandering friend of the program, Shante Leggett?
I'm not slandering anybody.
Slander. This is slander. Love okay, well, Shante.
Ask St. John's fans how they feel about Big East Coach of the Year, Mike Anderson.
Well, Mike, that's St. John. Again, Brad, Portland won one conference game total from 2018 to 2021.
But we get these wacky things because the Coach of the Year is like weighted on expectation.
But
Josh Pastor looks ridiculous.
Isn't that the point of how you define who's a good coach is based on
the most important thing in coaching is getting the talent.
But he hasn't had time to get the talent, and he got enough talent to win seven games after winning one in the last 3 years. Whatever, we're not debating. I don't think the listeners give a shit about Shante Leggins' burgeoning WCC Coach of the Year candidacy. Anyway, we should probably get to Baylor.
I think they're cooked.
So Jonathan Chamwechachua goes down for the season with multiple ligament tears, is how it's being announced, in his knee. That injury looked bad. It was bad. They get blown out. They still blow out, excuse me, Texas over the weekend. Surprisingly, I guess, particularly given the fact that Texas has been playing good basketball lately, seems to be turning a corner. Baylor puts up, 80 points, really, scores it well against a very good Texas defense. Feels like they're starting to get healthy. They didn't have LJ Cryer in this game, but Flagler's back to full health, has been playing great basketball. Akinjo was excellent in this game. You had, Sohan starting to get back into it. My question for you, Brad,
why did he cut his hair?
Sohan? You were a fan?
Everyone needs to have something that allows me to distinguish them immediately from my couch. Whether one guy's got a headband, one guy's got pink shoes, one guy has the t-shirt underneath, or one guy has a big blue hair.
So Baylor without Shamu Chatwell, let's contextualize what he was for this team. He's their best rebounder, arguably one of the best rebounders of the nation.
Incredible role man.
Great role man. Shot 70% on twos. On very limited volume, 6 of 13 from 3 this season. Makes his free throws at 77%. A big-time leader. Switches. I mean, he is a really and he walls up defensively. He's a really valuable player.
I remember watching the tournament last year, and you'd watch him roll, off the ball screen. He would roll with such force and such speed that it was pulling help defenders from everywhere, and it was getting guys like Meyer open corner threes.
Yeah. No, he does a tremendous job. He leads them in offensive rating. Again, best defensive rebounder, most efficient offensive player on the interior. He's a huge, tremendous loss. And they don't have a true backup center. I mean, Zach Loveday was playing in garbage time. They lost Dane Danger early to a transfer. I'm not sure Dane was ready to play either. It seems like what they're going to do when Flo Thamba isn't on the floor, and Thamba's a good player, but he's probably not the guy you want playing 35 minutes a game. He doesn't have the stamina. You're probably going to see more Sohan at the five. How do you think that impacts Baylor's defense?
Well, it's going to be way more switchable. We just mentioned that JTT was excellent at switching, but Sohan's like a NBA first-round pick level athlete. And him, he's going to give up a lot of size. Trey Mitchell even, But, most of the other bigs, Texas Tech doesn't have a ton of size. I mean, Texas doesn't have a ton of size. Kansas doesn't even have a ton of size. They play Zach Clements at the five, and he does not look like a five when you watch him. They play KJ Adams some at the five. So maybe it won't be a huge issue in the Big 12. I guess if they've run into a team like an Illinois in the tournament or, a lot of these Big 10 teams, maybe size could be an issue, but pick and roll, that's going to be devastating, being able to switch off like that with your five man.
Yeah.
And then on the offensive end, Sohan's a better offensive player than JTT in terms of his shooting in perimeter game. He's not the same level of roller, so you're going to lose some of that, but just losing such a super glue guy like that is going to be tough. You mentioned Zach Loveday. I mean, he's the polar opposite to JTT, right? He's super tall and he shoots jumpers.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't really think there's a role for Loveday on this team, right? The way that they guard, I just don't think it makes sense. I think you have to try to play smaller. You have to spread it out, play a little bit faster. They need to get Cryer back. It sounds kind of odd to be like, you want the shortest guy or the second shortest guy on the team, back to help deal with losing center. But you need Cryer because you need your depth, right? It's easier to play three, a small. If you're going to play smaller, you need to have guards, right? Right now, without Cryer, they have seven guys that are playable, with Akinjo, Flagler, Brown, Meyer, Thamba, Sohan, and Dale Bonner. You probably want to get Cryer back in there so you can. Obviously you want Cryer because he's good, but one of the reasons you want to get Cryer back in there is you need to just have the guard depth. So I don't know that I'd say they're cooked. It certainly really hurts them.
They're cooked as a national title contender, but they can still maybe
even
win
the Big 12. You think they can't win a national title now? They could before, but they can't now?
Yeah.
So Bovada right now, it's 15-1. Same odds as Kansas. Final Four, it's 3-1. 3-1. I don't know.
I mean, I'm not convinced that they'll still lose the Big 12. I mean, Kansas doesn't scare me a ton.
No, not at all. I mean, that's the thing.
I mean, talking about working guys back, they're gonna have to work Remy Martin back. You know, they have their two NBA players, but McCormick's been up and down. Everybody hates McCormick. I mean, McCormick's going to be, like, such a prize of the transfer portal. Like, he's going to go and start at center for someone next year and light the world on fire. I can feel it. You know, Kansas is looking for answers. I mean, Jalen Wilson was better over the weekend, but Harris is a nice glue guy point guard, but they need someone off that bench to step up, and they need someone to really step forward at that center spot.
They're just very underwhelming, right? Like, the Oklahoma game was underwhelming. The Texas game was relatively underwhelming. They just don't look that talented, you know? Like, I don't watch them and say, man, it's, you know, it's a Final Four team. That's a scary Kansas team. That's a team that I don't want to play. Like, to me, I think they're better than they were last year. But, you know, the way they got wrecked last year in the NCAA tournament by USC, like, I could see that happening to them again. Just like the wrong team, you know, the wrong team catching. I mean, just like kind of Kentucky did. Like, they get caught by a team that's rolling, they could get popped.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was looking at the Big 12 earlier, more towards the bottom. And I was going through the remaining schedule and kind of signing a winner and a loser. I think it's more likely than not that the Big 12 only has four teams above 500 in league. I think only Texas Tech, Texas, Baylor, and Kansas are going to finish above 500. I think even TCU, which is like 5-6 right now. 5-5. I mean, they could finish 7-11 easily. I mean, they have a tough schedule, and unless West Virginia is just going to lay down and give everyone a win the rest of the way, we could see, you know, not only Iowa State at 6-12 like we talked about last week, but Oklahoma could be there. Yep. Kansas State is probably not going to be there. Kansas State is probably going to get like 8 or so league wins. But with their non-con losses, they'll have an ugly record too. So it's going to be interesting to see how the ugly conference records are going to affect the Big 12 selection.
Yeah, I tweeted about this, and I got some random pushback from people like, oh, you know, conference record doesn't matter. The committee says the conference record doesn't matter. Oh, you know, like Nebraska was 13-5 in the Big 10, and they didn't get in, so it's proof that the committee doesn't give a shit about conference record. It's like, okay, yes, but if anyone wants to tell me that there will be no consideration given to the fact that a team like Iowa State could conceivably come in last place in their conference, yes. Could go 5-13. Like, if they go 5-13, they will be 18-13 going to going into the Big 12 tournament. And there have been 18-14 teams that made the NCAA tournament before. So even if they lost first round Big 12 tournament, they went 5-13. There have been those types of teams before, and they have the wins. Like, they have the wins. They don't have any bad losses. Like that team will look like an NCAA tournament team on paper, or at least, like, right on the bubble, theoretically. As long as they're not getting blown out, they should look like that. But, I mean, what are the optics going to be if Iowa State at 5-13, or even at 6-12, but I think especially at 5-13, gets the NCAA tournament, right? Like, West Virginia, they have a couple non-con losses. Like, they're going to fall out, right? I think it's inevitable that West Virginia falls out. They're not that good. They don't have as good metrics all the way around. But, like, with Iowa State, again, what will the optics be of putting in a team that comes in last place, right? Especially because you know there's going to be the mid-major, right? You know it's going to be Belmont or, you know, Iona's kind of fallen off because he loses to Niagara and Siena. But Iona with Patino or, you know, like there's going to be three or four of these mid-majors with, you know, 26 wins and, you know, first place in their league or second place in their league. And they're not going to – they're going to bubble. And Iowa State's going to be there.
And what I mean, we know that one of Murray State or Belmont is going to be on the bubble.
Well, I think there's an argument to be in that Murray could be, like, not even on the bubble.
I mean, in
like, I think if Murray, if Murray wins out and then lose – if Murray wins out and loses in the conference tournament championship game, they wouldn't be on the bubble. They'd be solidly in the field.
So I'm on Seth Burns wins above bubble right now. He doesn't have it sorted by wins above bubble. He has it sorted by percentile, which I'm sure he knows what he's doing there. Or no, it's not even sorted by that. I don't know how it's sorted. It's sorted by something. Oh, I think it's sorted by parcels. Okay. But however he's sorted, Murray State is 10th and has 2.28 wins above bubble. So yes, they are pretty solidly in. And now we know that wins above bubble loves these plucky mid majors that have gaudy records.
It would be very funny, Brad, if we've made this joke all season. You go 22-0 so you can lose the 23rd gaming in that large bid. But if Murray State beats Belmont at home to end the regular season and then loses to Belmont in the conference championship game or loses to Morehead State, either way, they're going to have pulled that off.
Absolutely.
That would be what it was. Yeah.
You know, Davidson is 1.25. Loyola is 1.11. San Francisco is 0.65. SMU, 0.64. Ohio, 0.36. Ugh. Belmont, 0.42. And then you have South Dakota State, New Mexico State, Chattanooga, North Texas are all right on the cut line. Where if they
did Iona fall below zero wins above bubble?
What did you say?
Did Iona fall below wins above bubble?
Yes, they're the last. They're the first team out at -0.06.
That's beautiful.
Siena did that.
Yeah, shout out to the Saints, baby.
Trying to kill the Mac. Yeah.
Out for the Saints. Anyway, no, I do think Murray State is getting in. But yeah, I mean, look, the optics, like the impending optics, and West Virginia just lost tonight at Kansas State to go to 3-9. Iowa State's 3-9. Oklahoma State, I think, will get in.
Oklahoma,
that's what I meant. Yeah, sorry, yeah. Oklahoma's toast. Oklahoma, I think, probably will.
I don't think they're going to get in. I think that they're going to finish 6-12, and right, they have that loss to Butler.
Their problem is their other problem, of course, is their record because they played a little bit of a non-league.
They lost to Utah State as well.
Correct. So if they go 6-12, they go into conference tournament 16-15. That doesn't work. You're not getting in.
I mean, even if they were 7-11, they'd be 17-14, play a schedule like Alabama with Colin Sexton. Or Vanderbilt that one year where they can get in with that, you know, really ugly record.
I think what you're really approaching here, though, is you're approaching some, like, elimination games, right? Like, Oklahoma at Iowa State this Saturday feels like something of an elimination game. Because if Iowa State can't win at home against Oklahoma, where are the wins coming from, right? They're going to go, like, 4-14.
Yeah.
Oklahoma, on the other hand, if they can't win that game, they're not going to get enough wins total. So, you know, so Oklahoma's closing schedule is home Texas, at Iowa State, at Texas Tech, home Oklahoma State, home West Virginia, at Kansas State. So you either need two of the road games and beat Tech. You probably need to go 4-2. You go 4-2, you're going to be 8-10. You're going to be 18-13 going to conference tournament. You're going to go dancing. Right? You probably need 8-10. If you're Oklahoma.
Yeah.
If you're Iowa State, you have a little bit more leeway, right?
You can lose a single game in the non-league.
7-11 will do it for you for Iowa State.
You beat Xavier on neutral. You beat Memphis on neutral. You won at Creighton. And then they beat Iowa. Yeah.
6-12 50-50. 5-13, I don't think we'll do it. 4-14, definitely won't. 4-14 would be a DePaul level collapse by the Cyclones.
And you know, Texas A&M was always a paper tiger.
Oh yeah.
But they had nothing to speak of, and they got, you know, when they were 14-2 or whatever, they were put in the last fours on people's bracketologies. And now 8 straight losses later, which, I mean, that team has more talent than that. I mean, come on, Buzz. What's going on over there?
Shaky.
Is Marcus Williams the problem? I mean, he leaves Wyoming and they explode.
I do think it helped Wyoming that they could put the ball in Maldonado's hands more. I still like Marcus Williams, though. Whew. I'm watching Kansas, Oklahoma State as we podcast, and Musa Cisse just attempted to grab and go off of a rebound and precisely dribbled twice and then threw a pass directly to Christian Brown. It was great. Oh. Anyway.
Hey, remember the Rostein tweet from the preseason with Mike Boynton told them that Matthew Alexander Moncrief was going to play some point guard?
How's that gone?
Haven't watched enough Oklahoma State. Is he playing point guard?
I haven't watched much. Getting NCAA tournament ban makes you so irrelevant. There's no point.
It does.
Alexander Moncrief is like barely even playing. He's only playing like 20 minutes. He's only playing 15, 18 minutes a game.
And Cisse starting over Caleb Boone. Or at least he wasn't.
I see that.
I haven't checked in a while. Maybe that's reversed itself. But
he started today. But anyway, yeah, that's the Big 12. Where else should we go? Been to the Big 10, been to the Big 12, been to the WCC.
I think all 7 Big East teams are going to get in.
Creighton
has a pretty favorable schedule where they play.
It would be nice if the metrics were a little bit better.
Well, they're playing Georgetown right now, so this is a nice chance to add some cheap net points. I think their game against Georgetown on Saturday led to, I think, a 7-spot jump on the net.
Yes, 8, actually.
8, so hopefully they can win by enough tonight. Arthur Kaluma got hurt in the game against Georgetown, so he's out. But Creighton's a weird team where I think that they're probably good enough to get in, but Ryan Nemhard looks like he's completely out of gas. I mean, he has to do so much of the ball handling, so much of the creation.
I mean, he's playing 35 minutes a game as a freshman in college. It's harsh.
Sharif Mitchell has basically been out for the season. I think he played a couple games in the non-con and has been out ever since. Trey Alexander's made a nice jump, and he's been the backup point guard. He's looking like a real promising player, but he's not giving them that secondary creation that they could really use. Kalkbrenner's a monster. Hawkins is really good. O'Connell's shooting it better. They just go through some just in unbelievable dry spells offensively. The defense is pretty solid, but offensively, you know, they can be tough to watch. So as long as they can take care of business, and then I think they have Seton Hall at home. I think they have UConn at home. So their tougher games are at home. So that's their path there. They don't need to do anything crazy to finish above 500 in the Big East. Things are looking pretty good for all 7 to make it. I know a bunch are falling out of the top 25. I don't know why we're so quick to dismiss Marquette, especially as a top 25 team over one game, but what are we going to do?
Agree. I do think Creighton's in good shape. They're currently handling Georgetown right now. You do have to finish if you're Creighton. You got to win some of these home games, certainly, and you might even want to steal one on the road, but
they should be able to waltz to 10-9. And now, will that be enough? I don't know, but they don't have to do a lot of heavy lifting to get to 10-9.
Yes. Obviously, DePaul's been feisty. DePaul, man, has been feisty.
DePaul's good. Like, they're not good in the sense that they're a top 100 team, no, but like they are.
I think they are probably a top 100 team.
Sorry, yeah, I said top 100 when in my brain I was thinking like top 50, but I mean, they have a lot of size.
Yes.
With Brandon Johnson and Yorne and
they're Nick hard to play against.
Yeah, they play really hard. David Jones is very, very good.
And the thing that's interesting to me, that there hasn't been a huge drop off without Freeman Liberty with the groin.
No, because I mean, in the Providence game especially, I mean, Terry and McCauley both hit multiple jumpers. Jones was on fire for a stretch. Johnson, sixth year senior, he's been great, and you know, they beat up Providence on the glass with all that size and athleticism.
Had Judah Mintz on campus this week, per source.
Saw that as well. His list, right, so he was committed to Pitt. He opens up. He is about to visit Xavier, but then they take Desmond Claude, who's a top 100, like a shooting point guard, like more of a long-range shooter. So then he cancels his visit to Xavier. And his four teams that he's visiting, DePaul, NC State, Wake Forest, and Syracuse. What just like a random list for a top 50 recruit?
Syracuse is apparently in good shape from what I hear. DePaul in good shape as well. NC State would be weird. NC State's in a weird spot though because NC State has to figure out where Keats is potentially hot. But he's been good at getting commitments from good recruits,
yeah,
especially when he's hot. With Dillingham, obviously Josh Hall, Jalen Lake. Keats is potentially hot. You have
none of those guys came to school.
No. Well, Dillingham we'll see. But I don't see that ever.
I don't think that's gonna happen.
You have Sebrin potentially going pro. You don't know yet.
Brad, do you ever transfer to another team that he considered out of high school?
I was gonna say, do you ever stay up at night wishing you had Darian Sebrin right now? Or are you just happy with Justin Mania?
Well, I mean he wouldn't be Justin Mania. He would be
right
the Al Durham role, but instead of Durham can't shoot this year from three. So
I think of him like kind of Alpha Diallo like almost.
I think he's a better athlete than Diallo. Sebrin is really good at getting to the rim.
Someone described him to me as like Najee Marshall without the good parts of Najee Marshall.
No, I wouldn't say that. He's huge. He can handle the ball and he can really get to the rim. And he's not a good shooter. I don't know how his defense is. I was just enamored with him, slithering to the basket. I would love him on next year's Providence team. But anyway,
and there's also the potential for a Terquavion Smith surprise one and done.
One and done, you think?
That's what there's been some buzz.
I mean, he can really, really score.
Really go. Yeah.
He can really shoot it, but one and done seems a little rich.
I agree. But, I mean, Kevin Keats has been killed by the early entry.
No one survives the early entry.
But they've been, I mean, they've been bludgeoned by the early entry.
How about this? Do you remember in the offseason when Manny Bates was supposed to transfer to Georgetown?
I do remember that.
Think about that butterfly effect. Instead of playing Mutombo and Malcolm Wilson and Ego Efe, you're playing Manny Bates.
Well, do we think he would have stayed healthy? Are we planning on any hypothetical?
I mean, he would.
He wouldn't have been in the place where he got
during
injured.
NC State's first game, so yeah. he would be at Georgetown's first game. He'd be losing to Dartmouth.
Yeah.
Injury free.
Well, they would have beaten Dartmouth with Manny Bates.
Yeah.
Maybe. Speaking of Georgetown, we should probably at least discuss the Ewing situation. I mean, I assume you're of the belief you just have to move on, right? Like.
Right. But
I mean, I'm not. I think it's a little more complicated, but knowing you, I assume you're just like, fire him.
Well, no, I get what. On Field the 68, what Randolph Children was saying is that
Randolph had a good, a much more nuanced opinion.
No, and I wouldn't think fire him. I've been saying since almost the Dartmouth game that I think after this year, Ewing was going to say, screw it, I quit.
Right.
But I mean, I don't know Ewing's personality at all. Maybe his reaction to this year wouldn't be, I I hate this, I quit. You know, maybe it would be, we're going to get him next year, you know, in which case you have Patrick Ewing as your coach next year. But in the ESPN article that Myron Metcalf wrote about a month ago, or maybe it was the Washington Post one by Candace Buckner. I don't remember which one. But like one of the first lines of the article was Ewing complaining to the journalist about having to recruit. So I think that lends more credence to the he might just say, forget this, I'm out of here at the end of the season.
Especially because, like, if he's going to be back, it's going to have to be with a completely new staff. Right? Like, currently he's worked, and they've had staff continuity. So he's been with people he worked, he knows, people he likes, presumably, for 4 years, 5 years now.
That's got to be so incredibly awkward to be like, I know that this is probably on the players or maybe me, but all three of you are fired. Sorry.
And make the AD tell him.
And the rest of us will just soldier on.
See if we can get a big East win next year.
Thanks.
I mean, I think the most obvious thing that makes it clear why Georgetown is not very good is the fact that Donald Carey plays a significantly larger role on this Georgetown team than he did at Siena.
I mean, Carey's pretty good. I mean, you guys were saying on Field of 60 that only Muhammad would play on their teams. Carey, I think, would play on every other Big East team.
No, would start.
Well, no, like that would be situational, obviously.
Yeah, I don't think of Don as like a starting caliber shooting guard in the Big East.
No, but if you have him as a fourth or fifth year player, whatever year he's in,
he's a fine player.
Yes, shooting the ball like that, he has pretty good size. But yeah, the Georgetown team has no talent and. It's probably because they couldn't get any of their fifth-year guys to come back for the COVID year.
Which is concerning. Do you think that's concerning? Right? Like
it has to be concerning. When Providence gets Nate Watson to come back after averaging like 16 points a game, Xavier gets Paul Scruggs to come back, UConn gets Whaley and Polly to come back.
Up to these days?
What was that?
What is Trudier Belay up to these days?
Exactly. I mean, he was the one that I was really surprised about. And, you know, in hindsight, at least Pickett made the NBA – as a two-way player with the Pistons, Blair, is he that much better than Carey? I mean, he wouldn't solve any of their issues on the defensive end, certainly. He's probably a better player than Carey, probably a little more diverse shot maker. But Belay, I mean, you have a gaping hole of power forward. He played great last year. He would have been perfect to stick in there. And then you have Holloway coming off the bench, you know, but...
He appears to play for the Greensboro Swarm. Statistics.
I thought Georgetown was such a great job. They can't pony up $40,000 in NIL money for Mr. Belay.
He's averaging 5.4 points per game in the G League. So.
And then, you know, I was pretty optimistic about Ego FA coming into the year, but... too much Ego FA. Too big of a dose of Ego FA. we need to go back to like eight minute of game Ego FA.
Yeah, he's serviceable for 10 minutes.
He's very big. He moves okay. But when he's playing 25 minutes, it's like, okay, he's just not doing anything right now.
I don't know why I found that so funny.
Well, I mean, in the Providence, I mean, you know, nobody loves Alan Breed more than me.
Oh, yeah.
But
you're a big Breed guy.
Al Durham was hurt in the second half. He's been hurt, I guess, for 2 weeks. When he comes out of the game, he goes and rides the exercise bike in the tunnel. First game, I had a heart attack. I didn't know where he was. He wasn't on the bench. Anyway, he comes out of the game early second half and is like ice in his hip. And we got like a 8-minute stretch of Alan Breed. And it was too much Alan Breed. And I love Alan Breed. And that was too much Alan Breed. But anyway,
any other revelatory takes like too much Timothy Ego FA today? Or do you have a? Are we inching close to a wrap up here?
Oh well, the other guy I was really hoping for that maybe would want to transfer to Providence after the year was Nate Leshefsky.
Yeah.
But now Notre Dame's too good that like he wouldn't, you know, the whole pitch would be...
Unless Bray retires.
I could see that, yeah. But the original pitch would be, you've never played in the NCAA tournament, dude. And look at what Horkler just did as a white shooter and power forward.
Yeah, but Horkler's got some shit to him, you know.
Yeah, he's a good athlete.
Very soft.
7 rebounds a game. Must be because he's playing a lot of five.
Someone has to grab those rebounds.
Yeah, when Atkinson's out of the game. But
Notre Dame, though, I mean, I think they deserve a lot of credit. I mean, again, a lot of it's like, you know, circumstance, right? You get somewhat lucky that Blake Wesley decides he wants to stay home. He's a South Bend kid. You get this kind of stud right in your backyard.
I mean, your recruiting. That can't be luck. I mean, come on.
It can't be luck that a kid grew up in your backyard and wants to play for you? They couldn't get recruited during COVID, nobody took official visits?
But, like, if him being so good is lucky, then everything's lucky.
Well, no. I'm saying you got lucky timing-wise that the time when you're, like, stud local kid, when Brace, you know, when he comes, is when Brace recruiting has fallen off and he's the missing piece to a veteran team.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. It's lucky. It's not like, oh, wow, we just got lucky that Blake Wesley exists.
Because, I mean, that's mid-major basketball. Oh. Right? It's like, oh, Mike Dom fell out of the sky and we get four years of
Jalen Pickett. I mean, Jalen Pickett, yeah. Jalen Pickett had no offers. Seattle only offered him because they had a new coach and like 8 spots to fill with like no time. I was like, let's give this kid a shot. He's an Albany City Rock.
Got Adonis Arms, Chandler Vaudrin, and DJ Burns just like falling from the heavens.
you underestimate the work it takes to recruit good players to mid-major.
Well, it's like you find a guy and you're just convinced he's a stud. And then you just gotta hope that no one else thinks.
Notices. Yeah. Well, I mean, I was writing my David Roddy feature. I appreciate everyone who shared that, gave some kind words.
I read it.
Wow, look at you.
What'd you think? Out of articles though.
No. Can't read my brackets.
No, I couldn't read the Emerald Code one. I clicked on it while I was suffering through Love Is Blind. Clicked it. I was like, I don't think so.
I was getting texts from coaches like all morning, like, oh, where are we in your bracketology? I said, just, you know, you guys are spending too much money at the bar and not enough money on Sports Illustrated subscriptions.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was a good story. I thought it was a good story. I think he's an interesting kid. But one of the things, and it kind of goes to the mid-major recruiting thing, was, you know, in talking to Dave Thorson and Nico Medved, who recruited him, like, they were panicked as they're watching him get better and better. Like we're not gonna get this kid. You know, somebody's gonna offer him from Vegas. And Minnesota offered him, and Northwestern offered him, but Roddy had the relationship, and he's really good. I don't know if you've watched him, Brad, but holy cow!
Yeah, I've watched Colorado State a bunch. They're the mid-major team I'm most scared of.
They're very entertaining to watch. They play much more like exciting brand of basketball than like, I mean, Loyola plays it this year. Like last year, Loyola is not very fun to watch unless you like cutting people to death. Like I enjoyed watching like Cameron Crutwig like kind of stare people down and dribble into post ups and all that shit. But I think the average Joe probably prefers the average Joe probably prefers the Colorado State kind of run up and down, shoot threes, space the floor, everybody handles it. Loyola kind of does that now.
They move Roddy to the five, and then they got, you know, Tanji's a shooter, and
Tanji's really
good. Two great guards. It's scary stuff.
Chandler Jacobs played a really good game yesterday for them against Boise. That could be an X factor. He's been a disappointment, but try to make shots. I mean, he's super long. His arms are, like, unbelievable.
I think we all collectively forget, and me especially, that, right, transfers are recruited to start right away. And like make an impact right away, but you still have to be patient. And Jared Bynum's really shoving that in my face right now.
Yeah, you kept telling me that the early in the season the carriage was turning into a pumpkin.
I mean, now he comes back from injury and he's getting to the rim, he's shooting threes. I mean, even before 25-6 versus DePaul. He was first team all Big East level. In conference, he was averaging like 15 a game, leading the number one team in the conference, 4.5 assists leading Providence, right? and shooting like 46% from three. You know, that's first team all Big East. And it's just a patience thing. I mean, I was ready to give up on Jameer Harris for Seton Hall. He's starting to turn around a little bit. Kenari Richmond is not quite where we thought he would be, but he's starting to turn it around. You know, some of these guys take multiple years, you know.
Fair enough. We should keep that in mind, though, for next year. I mean, we've done so much with the portal.
Yeah.
And it's just patience. Like, oh, Jared Bynum stinks. And maybe, again, part of that was COVID, but I think there is like a – something you said is more teams kind of build it. And more teams – and we talked about this over the summer of, like, teams like a Texas Tech where they're taking 7, 8, 9 transfers. Like, you're not just plugging them in to start because all of them can't start, right? So it's like, okay, yeah. You know, Kevin McCullough leaves, whatever. Or not Kevin McCullough. Starter Calhoun leaves, whatever. But, you know, it's like Malik Wilson going to be a guy next year. You know, he's been banged up, whatever. You know, they kind of go through it in those types of examples. KJ Adams, like, I see a guy next year. Bacho, like, I'm a Bacho guy. I'm a Bacho believer. Bacho Hive.
Seeing him in person, he looks absolutely enormous.
Well, he's a monster.
Yeah. No, and then the unexpected waiver guys have almost 100% all turned it around. I mean, between Alex O'Connell, Croswell, Trey Jackson for Seton Hall, it is a real player. Even like Jose Perez, who had to leave Marquette when Wojo got fired, he's balling out of Manhattan now.
I know. Manhattan still stinks, but...
is a buy stock in transfers with multiple years and be patient.
Yes. Anything else, or should we wrap up with 4 weeks to go until Selection Sunday?
That's it, 4 weeks? Wow.
Yeah. I'm going to have to get a hobby again in like 8 weeks. It sucks.
Watch some TV.
Oh, plenty in the hopper, baby. Plenty in the hopper.
What's next up for you?
Well, I just finished – I was watching the second season of the Power reboot Ghost with the story of Tariq. Now I'm watching the one with Tommy Force. So I'm kind of watching that live. I'm watching Billions live. I don't have a lot of time for TV right now, Brad. I'm doing a lot of games.
Was the Coach Calipari episode aired yet of a Billions?
I think it aired last night. I haven't watched it yet.
No, I mean, no one loves TV more than me, but I've been down to like one episode a night, if that. You know, yeah, Tuesdays, tough. No episodes.
Yeah. It's tough sledding.
Yeah.
Tough sledding. But, all right, folks. We will see you all next week with another episode. Thanks for tuning in.